done and a couple other people recommended. I see a documentary on Netflix called 13th. Have you ever seen that? It's about 13th Amendment. It's really a nice review expose on racism. Have you seen it?
No, not bad. I wanted to tell you, I did have an
inspiration. Oh, okay. Save it. Save it. So, 13th. It's about, incarceration in the United States. We have 5% of the world's population, and we have 25% of the world all the people in the world are incarcerated. We have 25% of those, even though we only have 5% of the population. Black males, I don't know if it's black males or just black people are 6% of the population, but they represent 50% of the people that are incarcerated. So the documentary does a really nice job of kind of explaining that. The historical underpinnings of that. So let's continue with our study of the Heart Sutra. So Buddha goes into Samadhi and it comes out from that place and says to Avalokiteshvara, you are the manifestation of compassion. Please give an exposition about prajna, practicing prajna, or the practice of emptiness. So what we've learned in the last couple lectures is that so prajna is wisdom that goes beyond wisdom. So the Heart Sutra is addressing transcendental wisdom. It's addressing that wisdom which is, you know, beyond knowledge, beyond just accumulating facts. It's some intuitive sense about the reality of how you position yourself in the universe and how the universe wraps itself around you. And I was saying last time, particularly in Zen, we practice prajna often very tactfully, how we relate to objects, how we relate to people. It's not so much, you know, it's not an intellectual practice, even though that's part of the practice of prajna, like we're doing right now. But it's very much about how you relate to everything in your life, the wind, you know, the sky, the flowers, the food that you touch, the food that you eat. How do you begin to come into a relationship with that where you really feel how all of that supports you? And how you support it. And I like the word that Norman uses. He says he talks about it in terms of where the practice of prajna, as you begin to see the nature of reality as not being solid and concrete, but a flow, something that's ever changing, one flowing into the other. That his word for that is like big love, big compassion, that everything, even those things that we want to kind of put off to the side, that we don't want to relate to, that everything is supporting everything else. So we're still working on the same phrase. Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply the prajnaparamita, perceive that all five aggregates, or the original translation is skandhas, which we'll talk about, in their own being are empty. And because of that understanding, of that transcendental wisdom, all was saved from all suffering. So that should get our attention. How could that help us with our suffering? So one thing that's important is that from our perspective in Soto Zen, especially Dogen, is the emphasis was not that you get this enlightening experience. You know, it's true. You get a sense of aha moments. Aha. Aha. You're at the beach and suddenly there's just you and the waves and the beach and your mind is very quiet. Aha.
you know.
Or whatever moves you, you know, a series of aha moments. But Dogen says it's not something you're moving towards. Enlightenment is out there. It's like the word that he used is so beautiful. It's like practice realization. You're always in practicing, in being present with your life, and being present with your aliveness. That is enlightenment. That is, in fact, enlightenment. I know it doesn't feel that way. Sometimes when you're sitting, your knees hurt, and your back is, you know, a little bit tense or whatever, or you're staying with your depression or whatever. That practicing being with your aliveness and your reality, you know, it seems like it should just feel maybe different, but more and more we deepen our appreciation for our whole and our complete experience. That practice and enlightenment arise simultaneously. So let's look at this word a little bit about skandhas, and I'll come back to it in a minute. So the aggregates or the skandhas, that was really instrumental in Buddha's first, the way he taught meditation practice. In fact, the idea is that you brought the skandhas into view. What does that mean? You bring the skandhas into view in your meditation practice. It means the skandhas, there are five skandhas. There's form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. And you bring them into view. In other words, in your meditation practice, begin to see, you know, the different aggregates that go to make yourself up. So, in other words, in Buddhist meditation, the idea was to begin to break down this sense of, like, this solid sense of self. You know, I am this man. I am this Zen priest. I am this person with these problems that don't change. You begin to break that down into these aggregates of, like, how do you create that? How is this created? You know, and it's created through these aggregates, through these skandhas that are constantly changing, constantly moving. So instead of focusing on the solidity of the self, Bruce, American, Republican, Democrat, or whatever, you begin to just see this as a constant flow. You begin to see yourself as a verb rather than a noun. And that has a substantial impact in terms of how you relate to yourself. Much more a sense of equanimity, much more a sense of patience, much more a sense of understanding of the sort of the totality of how you fit into things. It also meant that you are, in bringing the skandhas into view, you begin to see how you actually create your universe. So the eye, the sense organs, make contact. And when they make contact with something, usually a perception arises. It could be like, okay, that's a particular kind of bird. And you either like that bird or you don't like the bird. So then you notice that a feeling arises. So when I was saying earlier, notice when you go towards something or away from something. That's like bringing the skandhas into view. You notice that a thought arises, which usually represented from a memory, and that you begin to, a feeling is generated around that. And then the depth of the feeling moves more into what we call a samskaras. And the samskaras are a further intensification of that feeling. In other words, I really don't like that, or I really do like that. And so Buddha, through bringing in meditation practice, by watching how the mind works, we see how we're co-creating the universe. You know, and it isn't so much that we begin to break down this idea that the objects are out there and we're here. There's a separation. We begin to see that we're constantly co-creating our universe by how we work with it. So that's very empowering to actually see that. And I think a couple of weeks ago I was reminding you of one of the Lojan slogans, which I like a lot, is it's like three objects, three poisons, three seeds of virtue. So that's based on bringing these skandhas into view. So the three objects are, meaning all the objects, and then you begin to either have a positive reaction to it, a negative reaction to it or a neutral reaction. Usually it's neutral, but it can be just very minutely positive or negative. Then if you intensify that, you know, like there's a person, and through your condition you learned through tribalism, our various permutations of tribalism, I don't like those people. And then you begin to intensify that even more. Then you move into the three poisons. Either you really don't like them and you want to hurt them, or you've got to have it. You know, whatever it is, food, whatever your particular predilection for addiction is, you got to have it to be happy, right? So those are the three poisons. And then the three seeds of virtue are how you work with that. How do you work with the poisons? So what's interesting is, like, in earlier Buddhism, the emphasis was, well, just eliminate the poisons, get rid of them, drive them out, you know, kind of good, bad. But in working with a heart sutra is you begin to dance with them. You begin to see that actually in some ways you need these samskaras. You actually need your agitation, and you need your parts of your brain that react negatively, because it's in working with that that you begin to cultivate a sense of patience and equanimity. And most important is that you begin to see that everybody shares these feelings, these likes and dislikes. And how else are you going to create compassion except understanding that your suffering is identical, it's universal. And once we begin to see the universality of suffering, the First Noble Truth, it goes a tremendous way to alleviating a sense of isolation and your sense of suffering. So Avalokiteshvara begins to free herself from suffering through her practice of prajna. She begins to see that the actual nature of the world is caused by mistaking the world for something that it is not. We all think that the world is separate from ourselves. It's there, we're here, we're separate from whatever that is that we like or don't like. But Avalokiteshvara sees that totally not separate, because of how she's beginning to bring the samskaras into view. Maybe an analogy would be is like how many times some of us have, if you have a little bit of aversion towards snakes, for example, you see a rope and you think it's a snake. So we do that all the time. We're constantly mistaking through perception, through the samskaras, something that it is not. And so that's what happens in bringing the skandhas into view. You begin to see that the nature of reality, we think it's separate. What the Heart Sutra is saying, no, it's not separate. Keep practicing prajna and you'll see more and more, you'll begin to feel more and more this non-separation. And that's, of course, what the Heart Sutra is encouraging us to do. This body of very profound literature starting to be written about the first century and then before Common Era, and then continuing the body of literature until about 800 or 900, and then the Heart Sutra condensing that probably around 2nd, 3rd century into this one very succinct sutra. So myself usually is made up of work, gender, possessions, what we have, our wealth. And when these things are taken away, then we suffer, because our identity is so strongly wrapped up with these things that we've concretized ourselves around. So the more that we see that this really isn't our identity, you know, that just always having good health is our identity. No, we begin to see that that's only part of what we think of ourselves, a very limited way of thinking about ourselves. So the way to study prajna, three ways to study prajna, is one is like the we're doing now, kind of more intellectually. The other way to think about it is that you begin to feel it in your life. What inspires you? What inspires you more to feel your connectivity, right? So actually having kind of a deep experience. And in fact, we need all three. We need to have a sort of an intellectual understanding of it. We need to chant it as sort of a calling, like, what could this be? You know, I said that for maybe the first 15 years I chanted this, I didn't really study it very much. I didn't actually even know so much what a lot of these terms were, you know. But I began to wonder about it. Wow, all these hundreds of people are chanting this thing all the time at every moment throughout the world. There must be something tremendously inspirational in this particular practice. During the fire, I was reading how people responded to the fire, and I remember there were at least one example of somebody who, when their house was destroyed, there was this one dentist that he couldn't take it. It was just his identity was so strongly wrapped up in his house that he committed suicide. And there are a lot of people, understandably, that became very depressed. But there were other people. I was fortunate enough to, my sister-in-law, I know she has other things that bother her, but she felt kind of liberated. Her identity was not around what her house was or what her possessions were. And she just felt kind of like, oh, start over. So the practice of emptiness and the practice of projas can help us move more towards that kind of letting go-ness. So let's take the next phrase. So Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply, perceived that all the aggregates were empty and thus saved all suffering. That's the first line. Then the next line is, O Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. So, like I mentioned before, Shariputra, so Avalokiteshvara is addressing this to Shariputra. Shariputra is the sort of the number one disciple of the Buddha, one of the first disciples that came to the Buddha. And he was the one that was the most proficient in the study of the Abhidharma. The Abhidharma, part of the Abhidharma is actually bringing the skandhas into view. He was the most proficient in being able to talk and to lecture and to give discourses on why it's important to begin to see yourself as these aggregates rather than the solid self. He was the most proficient in that. But what all of Avalokiteshvara is saying is, that's true, but I'm encouraging you, Shariputra, because you're the wisest. Each of the disciples had a certain, like Ananda had a great heart, you know, Magalyana had more of a magical quality. Shariputra, he's saying, I want you to go a little bit deeper. There's a deeper understanding about how to work with these skandhas. It would be a little bit like, you know, so people, if you're studying the body, for example, you see the body, then you begin to see that the body is made up of different organs. And then you begin to see that the organs relate to one another. That's a further understanding. Then you begin to see, at some point, people begin to understand, wow, there's this thing called molecules. And then you begin to see that molecules are made up of atoms, and atoms are made up of protons and neutrons. And then you keep going further, and you see that protons, neutrons, and atoms, they're just energy. And so in some ways, the thing this is helpful for me is to think that Avalokiteshvara sees that, yes, it's helpful to see that there's neutron, protons, and how all that operates. But what Avalokiteshvara is saying is, begin to see the whole thing as like energy. He's sort of discoursing transcendental wisdom in the realm of like quantum physics in some ways. He's asking Shariputra to deepen his understanding of what the skandhas are. That in fact, matter and energy are one. That form, the realm of form, is the same as this thing that we call emptiness. consciousness or the absolute or God. In Buddhism, God is not other than how we create the universe through form, through feelings, through our perceptions, through our formations, and then our consciousness, which actually ties it all together. So this is profound, actually, because in earlier Buddhism, the emphasis, again, kind of moving through a continuum of understanding, in early Buddhism, it was more about a little bit achievement-oriented. It was like if we just could eliminate the samskaras, if we could just eliminate greed, hate, and delusion, if we could do that, that is what nirvana is. Nirvana was kind of out there. You do a lot of really hard work, hard meditation, and you eliminate greed, hate, and delusion. It's kind of a purification system, which is the way most religions operate, purification system. But what the Heart Sutra is beginning to say is, you are already purified. The nature of reality exists. It already exists within you. You know, it isn't like suddenly you're going to transform yourself into this place that's different than what you are right now. You already are it. And so that's has a very substantially different feeling. So you're both concurrently sitting on your meditation and paying attention to when greed, hate, and delusion arise. But you also have this kind of warm feeling that you already are enlightened, that you already are Buddha. And that was a very different attitude towards practice. It was a much more generous, lighthearted way to go about practicing. So that's why in the Lotus Sutra, this is one bodhisattva called Bodhisattva Never Disparaging. So Bodhisattva Never Disparaging never disparages anybody. And he never disparages himself. And of course, to make it interesting, everybody else disparages. Bodhisattva Never Disparaging. And there's this little song that they made up at Tassajara that they can sing, which we sung in here before a couple years ago, called Bodhisattva Never Disparaging. It says, the one line is, you only see your weaknesses, I only see your strength. And so old Buddhism is like really focusing on your samskaras. I mean, on your obscurations, you know, your hindrances, greed, hate, delusion, restlessness, doubt, you know. But the new emphasis was more, no, what I really see is that you're a Buddha. And you can see this like in the Dalai Lama. So it's where the Dalai Lama relates to people, and I'm using him as an example. He doesn't see people like, you are pretty screwed up. You have got to do a lot of work on yourself. Even though that may be true in some ways, and you can see the person suffering. What the Dalai Lama sees is, oh, you already are the nature of reality. Nature of reality is existing within you, and you just hopefully will begin to realize the reality that already exists, that you are part of everything. You know, you are part of everything, isn't out there, it's already existing. And that's a very substantial difference in how Zen and Mahayana Buddhism looks at things, because you begin to see form and emptiness are one, and at one level, you don't break it down. You're not breaking it down into good and bad. You begin to break out of that paradigm of good and bad. I'm bad, you're good. You're bad, I'm good. You know. You begin to see that everything. So when you say samsara, the world of suffering, and nirvana are the same, that doesn't make any sense at first. But if you begin to study the Heart Sutra, you can see why so many of the sutras are addressed to this, that you begin to see the totality. So I thought maybe, you know, there's one, I've been a little remiss. I haven't had us chant in here the harmony of difference and equality. And you don't have it, but if you do have it, I'm going to read it to you. This is on page 4. So again, the Heart Sutra comes into existence about 600 years after, 600 years after Buddha died. The whole emphasis of the Prajnaparamita literature. This is written about the 8th century. And this is by a really famous Zen master. So I'm going to read it to you and see if you can get the sense of what this harmony of difference and equality, the harmony of how everything fits together, that you don't need to put anything outside the circle. So first he says, the mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. That means Buddha Dharma is now being brought up into China. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. But he's addressing specifically, there was a little bit of a split in China, different schools about how they looked at things. He says, transcend that. You know, the Buddha's teaching is way beyond these kinds of differences. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark. So light and dark. You know, usually our spiritual path, we just go to the light. But here we're beginning to say, no, wait, there's something in the dark, too, that's important. Grasping at things is surely delusion, right? Grasping at things is delusion. I've got to have this. But according to sameness is also not enlightenment. In other words, you just don't make everything, you know, like and sometimes we say, well, everything's just all one. You know, no, sameness is, differences is important too. All the object of the senses interact as one, and yet they do not. There are individual forms. Interacting brings involvement. Otherwise, each keeps its place. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. See, refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. The four elements return to their natures just as a child returns to its mother. Fire heat, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sight, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste. Thus, with each and everything, depending on these roots, these differences, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence. Revered and common, each has its speech, its value. And these are the two phrases I like. In the light, there is darkness. But don't take it as darkness. In the dark, there is light. But don't see it as light. Light and darkness oppose one another like the front and the back foot in walking. You need both, the light and the dark. Each of the myriad things has its merit. Each of the myriad things has its merit. Even our states of mind, our myriad states of mind, has its merit. According to function and place, phenomena exist, box and lid fit, principles respond, arrow points meet. Hearing the words, understanding the meaning, don't set up standards of your own. Don't divide things out into good and bad. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of far or near. But if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you to study the mystery. Do not pass your days and nights in vain. Please study Prajna. Please bring emptiness more into your everyday life. So our practice, because we don't, you know, it's not about so much about purifying ourselves, it's just about unfolding the beauty of reality as it exists. So our practice becomes a delight and a joy, even if it's hard work sometimes. So the attitude is different. So that's a substantial change in terms of how we begin to look at our practice. We both do the hard work, you know, but we also have a deep sense of faith of our intrinsic goodness. Or as Trungpa used to say, I love that phrase, your basic goodness. So it's kind of a difference between original sin and you spend your life trying to overcome original sin, you know, to know original goodness. You just have original goodness. So it's very, I find, a very inspiring, message. And so that's why the Dalai Lama can, this is from the Bodhisattva, the way of the Bodhisattva, the Bhattacharya Vatara by Shanti Deva, about the 10th century. We've studied this a couple of years ago in the past. So this is a phrase, and the Dalai Lama says this every morning from the Bodhicitta Vatara, how to be a Bodhisattva, how to practice from the place of emptiness where I am connected to everything. May I be a guard for those who are protectless, a guide for those who journey on the road, for those who wish to cross the water. May I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an island for those who yearn for land, a lamp for those who long for light, for all who need a resting place, a bed. For those who need a servant, may I be their servant. May I be a wishing jewel, a vase of wealth, a word of power and supreme healing. May I be the tree of miracles, and for every being, the abundant cow. Just like the earth and space itself, and all the other mighty elements, for boundless multitudes of being, may I always be the ground of life, the source of varied substance. Thus, for everything that lives, as far as the limits of the sky, may I be constantly their source of livelihood until they pass beyond all sorrow. So I'd be pretty powerful if you chanted that every morning and really tried to live from that place. And that's what Avalokiteshvara does. That's why she's teaching the Prajnaparamita. She hears the cries of the world, and then in all her multitudinous ways, she finds the appropriate response, which can be giving food or shelter, a kind word, or maybe just silence and your presence. So maybe that's good for today, Bob.